I was stuck going to the training. It was really the best thing that ever happened to me because it changed the trajectory of my career. It was a learning process for me that took years to truly learn how to make a connection with somebody else through empathy. And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person. So we have a responsibility to represent law enforcement as a noble profession and do it the right way. You know, David, if I came to you and said, do you want to go play softball with me Tuesday night with this group from church? And you tell me, well, I'd like to play, but I'm actually supposed to see my therapist Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. Like, that should not shock my conscience, right? I should be like, okay, that's cool. Good for you.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-hosts, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumely, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Ernie Stevens from the Emmy Award-winning documentary on HBO, Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops, about intersections of mental health and law enforcement. Catch all our episodes by liking and subscribing on YouTube, Respond to Resilience channel, or on Facebook, Respond to Wellness Inc., EBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and go to our website, ResponderTV.com, for all the past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Ernie after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumely, LCSW, EMTB.
We're very pleased to welcome Ernie Stevens to the show today. I'll tell you a little bit about him. Ernie's a published author with a number one selling book on Amazon that's titled Mental Health and De-escalation: A Guide for Law Enforcement Professionals. Ernie was also a contributing author for Police Mental Barricade. Ernie was a police officer for 28 years, serving 26 of those years with the San Antonio Police Department, where he was a founding member of the mental health unit. Ernie's also been featured on the Emmy Award-winning HBO documentary, Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops. He's also been featured on NBC's documentary, A Different Kind of Force, and was interviewed by ABC Nightline's Byron Pitts on a feature about officers trained to respond to mental illness calls. Ernie continues to assist communities to build and program manage multidisciplinary response teams in his current position as Deputy Director for the Council of State Governments Justice Center. A warm welcome to Respond to Resilience, Ernie.
Hey, well, thank you so much, David. I appreciate you being here. When we first got in contact with each other and I found out the foundation of your podcast, it truly touched me knowing that it's saving lives. So thank you. I'm honored to be a part of this conversation.
Absolutely. We're excited to jump in. And Stacey, why don't you kick it off?
Yeah. So, Ernie, how did you become involved in crisis intervention? What kicked that off for you?
It was a complete accident. I had absolutely no desire. You got to remember, in 2003, when I was with the San Antonio Police Department, we didn't have a mental health unit. There was no mental health training in the academy at that time. Mm-hmm. So really, it was non-existent. It was whatever our field training officers or another officer showed you is really what you learned. So for me, it was actually my day off. I was assigned to the gang unit. A tactical response unit within the department, and my friend signed me up for this class called crisis intervention training that was going to be hosted by the Houston Police Department. And when I got back to work, I was told I was going to training, which was, that's a good deal because you get a week off at night and go to school during the day, right? And you get that weekend off prior to the training. But when I found out what the training was about, I truly was not interested at all. In fact, I did everything I could to try to back out of the training because I did not join the police department to answer calls about mental health. I had no idea.
Yeah.
The longest time that I had been doing it anyway. just wasn't doing a very good job. So I was stuck going to the training, and it was really the best thing that ever happened to me because it changed the trajectory of my career and opened up my eyes to a subject that I was very ignorant about when it came to mental health and really what the community expected of first responders when they called for help, and then also how scared they were and why they wouldn't call for help. So it really was an eye-opening experience to go to that training and transform my entire career path.
So something that struck me in the documentary, Ernie, is when you and Joe are with people in crisis, being able to treat them with dignity and respect. And that's something that really isn't taught in the police academy or EMT classes. How did you pick that piece up?
For me, right? Because I didn't know about mental health. The biggest barrier in learning about mental health was myself. I had to learn to overcome the stigmas of what I thought about mental health. And then I had to educate myself of what truly mental health was about. So it was a learning process for me that took years to truly learn how to make a connection with somebody else through empathy and through rapport. You're right. You can't, it's difficult to teach connection, human connection with others, right? Because in the police department for years and years, the antiquated way of teaching was I'm going to ask you to do something, then I'm going to tell you to do it, and then I'm going to have to make you do it. Mm-hmm. And it's that way still today in the military. And it just makes no sense because that's not how we should be treating our community members. Mm-hmm. We should be treating them with patience and dignity and respect and equity. And it took time. And like I said, I had to overcome my own barriers to really become proficient in crisis response and understand that even though I didn't have a lot of trauma growing up in my life, unlike Joe, for those that have seen the documentary, I would still be able to connect with people. I just had to be upfront with that in talking with them to say, look, there's no way I can imagine what you're going through. I've never been through anything like that. But if you could help me understand, I would like to find a way to try to connect with you and see if we can help you. Whereas Joe, it was very easy for him to connect with somebody that's been through a traumatic event throughout their childhood and lives because he had experienced that as well. So we had to take different approaches in trying to connect with people. And the secret that we've always said when we're asked this question is you've got to learn how to look at the person and not the problem because the problem is really spurred by an emotional response to a situation, but that isn't the person, right? That's the problem. And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person to get them to trust you and be able to open up and be vulnerable.
Well, and I think you're paying homage to the fact that a crisis moment for an individual is when what they're trying to manage is far surpassing their coping skills to manage it. So if you understand that, I think that's what's making it easier for you to meet them where they are.
Right, because who defines the crisis, right? It's the person in crisis. Right. You know, when if they were to explain to me, well, you know, I'm in a crisis because of A, B, or C, and I'm like, well, why are you freaking out about that? That's nothing. To me, it may be nothing. Mm-hmm. To them, that is a crisis, and they define that as the crisis, and I have to see that and empathize with that.
And you show up as crisis cops with safety, providing listening, and providing options. Whereas I think the old school way is you know, the cops are going to be viewed as disciplinarians, like, oh no, I'm in trouble. And then they dig their heels in, or it escalates the situation, especially if they're in uniform.
Yeah, I mean, that's like showing up and putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole, right? It just there's not a whole lot you can do if you have that mentality. And unfortunately, you see that same type of approach in schools today, right? Yeah. Administrators come in, they see a problem with a child. Oh, that's a policy or a handbook violation, and there's going to be punishment, right? Where now we teach our school resource officers, hey, there's a different type of approach to this, and we're going to bring in our school administrators and counselors to show them, hey, We're taking this adult model and we're going to transform it into an adolescent model and use adolescent role players to try to do an alternative approach within the school. So the concept of crisis intervention training truly is de-escalation, active listening, rapport building, connection, linkage to services, But most importantly, it's also on the back end of these calls, because what a lot of people didn't see either in the documentary or what a lot of places don't do is wraparound services at the back door when somebody is re-entering back into the community after a treatment. So that to me is huge, because if not, all you're going to do is continue in the revolving door of crisis, police response, crisis, police response. And you really have to provide good access to care and treatment in order to stop that cycle.
I think you did that. You did that with Kendra. You would circle back around and check on her. Sometimes you couldn't find her and she was elusive. But I think, you know, that modeled the checking back in with somebody that you ended up saving.
Well, I mean, and I'm sure Bonnie can talk to this, but case management is such a huge part, right, of the healing process for somebody to truly understand what do I need in my life to make myself not just better, but being able to live these activities of daily living and enjoy life and be productive and find that happiness and joy again. And it takes time. And for police officers, we just don't have that. So what I like seeing in today's response is so many police departments are starting to look at alternative responses, whether they have a clinician assigned with them or assigned to the department or a specialized unit or a peer specialist. But that type of back end connection with a patient really is vital to their success.
And I think it also adds to disarming that person. And the next time, God forbid, they're in crisis again, which we know can be a pattern, they're only going to have a trust level with you. They're already going to know that it can be different, you know, and that these people care. And that's the model that we all came up in first responder world was, you know, you see them once and then you don't see them again and you have no idea what's happened. There's no closure. But in your model, it's really realizing that that's not how people work, you know, and for them to have that interaction with you and to have you call the next day or a week later to care, they're not familiar with that experience. And so I think it probably makes the trajectory for them easier down the road.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times people would ask, well, how do you guys judge success of your program? Well, success would be, right, if we never hear from that person again, that's good, right? Because if you're a person living with a mental health diagnosis, do you really want the police in your day-to-day life? Mm-hmm. You really don't, right? But on what you said, Bonnie, is so true, because to this day, I still have people that I've helped call me. Kendra, I just took her to lunch a few weeks ago. Still, this is years later. I'm still taking her to lunch and meeting her. And
awesome.
And yeah, I've had patients that I've helped in the criminal justice system, you know, navigate that, get charges dropped, get funding through Social Security disability, call me crying and like, you're not going to believe this. I just got my first Social Security check. And sorry, this, I get choked up when I talk about this. But when they tell me, like, I can take my mom to Olive Garden for dinner, like, to me, I take that for granted. I'm like, Olive Garden, like, really? And to them, like, to my friend Roy, like, he's like, yes, this is important. Like, I get to do that for the first time. And that means something, you know, to somebody that's trying to find joy and happiness and success. This is part of that treat. Giving them the ability and the tools they need to succeed is so vitally important.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's a sense of normalcy too. It's like, I can function just like everybody else. I just needed a little bit of help. Maybe I needed some therapy or I needed to get off of drugs or I needed some psychotropic medication, whatever the case may be, but I can still live a normal life.
Yeah.
And it comes down to trust.
Yeah.
You guys, you know, gave the gift of empowerment, it sounds like, to so many people out there. And it's wonderful you still have the connections after this amount of time. Ernie, I wanted to ask you a little bit about training. I know in the film there's scenes of role playing, and I thought that was, you know, very poignant the way you guys set up with actors, and it seemed very realistic. Can you talk a little bit about the value of that and some of the other what other successes you had in training?
Yeah, training was, I mean, when I went to it, I tried to get out of it, but it wasn't just the, I mean, role playing itself is like, oh my God, are you serious? I don't want to do this because you got to do it in front of your peers. So there was a couple of aspects to the training that were really important for me. And one was bringing in members of the community to talk to us. That was powerful because I never knew their position. I never knew their point of view of why they didn't want to call the police. I'm like, why wouldn't you want to call us? We'll show up. And then I'm like, show up and do what? Like, divert to what? take somebody where? So then I started to understand, like, oh, I get it. You have as much confusion as I do. And then the role playing, we used people from our local mental health authority that had interactions with people with diagnoses that would play these parts of somebody with depression or bipolar or PTSD. And we got to use what we learned in the classroom through active listening, de-escalation, and they would feed off of that. So it was extremely realistic. But what it also, this training did, it being so realistic, is it affects you as an officer extremely differently. I had officers stop, say, hey, you know what? Time out. This one's too close to home. Like, my wife lost a child, and this one's too close. I can't. And it's like, okay, that's all right. We had therapists on site for the training, which I've never had a therapist on site when I went to rifle school or bike school or what. Like, oh my gosh, shooting that paper target is so stressful for me. I need to, like, that never happened. But this type of training, that happened, and it affected people, and they cried, and they had to regroup and rethink and kind of self-center themselves again, take a few deep breaths and say, use your strength. You know what this looks like. You know what this feels like. Now, how would you approach this situation? You can empathize, right? You're able not only to allow them to vent, but you can validate their feelings, which a lot of people can't do in this situation, but you can. Mm-hmm. So the training to me, I think, was it was incredible when you do it right. Mm-hmm. And not every CIT training is the same, right? Mm-hmm. They're not centralized training. They're very decentralized. Right. Some of them are, oh, we'll check the box and do a 16-hour class with no role-playing and call it CIT training. You really do a disservice to your officers. It can easily be a two-week class, right? But this is a based on the Memphis model of 40 hours based on your community resources and then the foundational classes that they teach.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
Are you seeing any of this kind of training in academy classes or early on in law enforcement officers' careers? Is it being taught out there that you know of?
Yeah, so interesting question. The International Association, I'm sorry, I take that back. The CIT International, for years, I spoke to Sam Cochran and Mike Woody about this. They're the board of directors there, some of them the presidents and past president. Their stance, and I totally understand it, is that this training should not be taught to somebody unless they have at least 2 years of experience, right? It should not be taught in the academy because it's a very high level training. These cadets don't even know how to make a traffic stop yet. Like, I get it. However, in San Antonio, we did teach it at the academy level. And what we found was a few things. Number one, the cadets were going out on their ride-alongs and telling their officers about resources they didn't even know existed. They're like, hold on, where'd you learn that? Oh, they just taught it to us in CIT. And like, really? So that in itself is eye-opening because these resources change all the time. So it's good to stay up and current with it. But it was also crucial in the fact that when you graduate from the academy, you don't get to pick and choose what calls you go to. So if you get out and on day one, they say, hey, respond to this location, individual has bipolar disorder, punching holes in the wall. Negative. I don't have the training yet. I can't go to that. Right. You can't do that. So we found a lot of value in training them early on and then having them come back through with the refreshers and then getting an updated course. In Texas, we have the Sandra Bland de-escalation course, which is now required, which is kind of a continuation of the CIT training they do there based on an incident that happened to her with a state trooper. So there is quite a bit of mental health training in the state of Texas. It's just not like that in every state right now.
I loved that clip in the documentary where you had the two people come in from the community and one woman described her voices in her head. And when the newer officer stood up and asked all of those questions of her, like, what is it like for you? And do you feel like you're with the voice? Are they inside of you, outside of you? I mean, to be able to ask those questions is just so valuable because for that officer to go on a call with someone with voices, he'll have a frame of reference.
I am so glad that you mentioned that part of the film because I think unless you're a clinician or somebody that really understands this, that part of the film might have just gone over your head. But it is so important that you brought that up because that's exactly what the director of the film wanted to portray. Like, look, here's a brand new kid, 21 years old. His frontal lobe has not even completely formed yet. And he doesn't understand quietly what she's talking about. He's confused. So he needs her to explain it and make him understand it. And I love that. I mean, how for a cadet in the academy to have that kind of exposure to somebody who's willing to come in and be vulnerable and authentic, I think is I'm so glad, Bonnie, you mentioned that part of the film because it really was important for other law enforcement leaders to look at it and say, well, that's why this training should be important at the academy level.
Right.
So I wanted to talk about what I found the documentary to be deeply spiritual. And I wonder how officers in the Northeast are going to respond to it, because I think if there's anything that's missing from the Northeast, it's sort of the connection to chaplains and having being in touch with one's spirituality and what the job can do to you. So, there were some very, personal aspects of the documentary showing, for example, you with your family in church and Joe praying with the CIT team or the peer support team when two officers were shot. A lot of the trainings were done in churches, I noticed that. So if you could just comment on, the role of spirituality in sort of surviving a career as a police officer, number one, and number two, why do you think that there's like a regional difference in the United States, specifically comparing to the Northeast?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for asking that question, because when they were making the film, there was a question of, do we even include this? Because a lot of times film critics don't like you to touch the topic of spirituality in a film. However, that was because they're trying, because Jen was doing such a good job at capturing who we were behind the badge.
Right.
Part of that journey was following me and my family. Right. So she captured us going to church. That's a huge support system for me. My spirituality connected. That's my personal coping mechanism of connection to a higher spirit for me.
Yes.
The support system outside of the police department, because so many police officers, their friends are police officers and that. And I got to get away from that. because you hear the same stories, you hear the same cursing all the time. And it just, it wasn't good for me in my mind. I needed to be around like-minded people who just enjoyed each other's company and really put focus on family and church. So I'm glad that part was captured. It's strange because as this film traveled through the South and then up to the Northeast, I heard people say, "Wow, I can't believe that y'all would pray like that." And I'm like, "Really? Well, why not?" You know, I don't know. It's like there's a line right in the United States where you go above this line. It's question. I don't understand it, but I know for us, it's especially in Texas, it's almost I don't know. It's an everyday thing. I mean, for us to read and to pray and to give thanks and give gratitude because, like you said, it's you got to do more than just survive in this career. And that's unfortunately, that's where so many people say, what do you think a successful career in law enforcement or being a firefighter is, right? Well, I survived. That's it. That's all you did. You just survived. Like, why don't we set the bar a little higher? Can we not like make a difference? Can we not connect? Can we not start new programs that didn't exist? So I'm hoping that the film showed that that is possible.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you personally to have such personal things and being at church with your family shared in a documentary? I'm wondering what that felt like.
Yeah, it was a 3-year process, the filming was. So for them to follow me to church, to school, Joe during his divorce, to his soccer games, where that was his feel good moments. It really was, it didn't feel intrusive. It was just, wow, they're really going to capture a lot of who we are personally. I wasn't sure that's where the film was going to go, because I thought the film was going to be about, you know, our response to the community. Mm-hmm. And then we had an officer get killed. We had one get shot. We had 3 commit suicide during all this filming. It was like, the film's starting to take on another journey. It's like, wow, look how dangerous this job can be to yourself because of the rate of suicide. So very interesting.
It's almost like a subtitle could be like police or people too, you know? And I think that especially, you know, in this day and age, and in light of, I'm sure you heard about the two Bristol police officers, it was an ambush that just happened this past week. 3 officers were shot, 2 were killed, and it was staged. It was an ambush of police. And so, you know, I do think the documentary it really gives the human side of police officers. You know, they're not just disciplinarians. You guys have a soul, you have a heart, and, you know, you have empathy.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, with policing, just because you put a uniform on, right? And people say that all the time. That's not who you are. That's just what you do. But with that, with putting on that uniform comes a lot of responsibility, right? You cannot cross that line against the community to where now you have this this gap, right? This disconnect. So we have a responsibility to represent law enforcement as a noble profession and do it the right way. Mm-hmm. So when you do have these critical incidents like this, you have the support of the community, and you don't see this stuff on social media like, good, that's what they get. You know, there's such this divide right now that we've got to find a better way to connect with community and let them know, hey, just because we put the uniform on doesn't separate us from the community. It makes us more a part of the community.
I think that human side and how they captured your vulnerability to anyone that watches it, I think will have a new appreciation for police and what they have to do, and the toll that it takes on you as a human. It takes so much energy to do that job well. You know, like you said, survival, okay, everyone can survive, but to be good at it and to truly make a difference in the world, it takes so much energy.
Yeah, and for your viewers and listeners to this, I don't want to forget, let's not leave out the family, right? Because even though it takes a toll, and it took a toll on me, I retired in January of 2021. Mm-hmm. And it really didn't hit me until I had time to decompress finally, because I never had time to decompress. On my days off, I always worked. And for my own reasons, right? Everybody has their own reasons of why they do what they do. But the effect and toll it can take on the family members, I think, is something that needs to be talked about more, because they truly are the backbone to the success of these first responders. Without their support, their love, unconditional love, it really makes it difficult for us to do what we do. And that's, I think, why the rate of suicide, or not just suicide, divorce, is so high amongst these professions. Mm-hmm, is there's not that good communication between family, and you come home and you're mad, and you know, there's just that, just a disconnect. So you're right. It does take a toll on us, but what it does, secondary trauma to the family, is also critically important to keep in mind.
And I think I heard you say this another podcast. The term you used was that your wife was doing a ride along with you, and that, you know, she was essentially kind of a, you know, proxy to the calls you were going on and coming back home with.
Yeah, I mean, every night I went to work, basically she went on a ride along with me, not physically, but when I got home, she got to hear all about it. Because so my wife and I, we've known each other since the third grade. So like we communicate about anything and everything. There's nothing that's off limits. There were times where I would close myself off if it was something really bad that I just did not want to let out, that I needed to kind of hold it together for my family. I didn't want them to see me weak or vulnerable in that particular moment, which was not healthy. But me and her, it was easy for me to come home and be like, I got to tell you about what happened last night. And it's not fair to do that, right? Because then she has to carry that baggage. So we made sure that we always had, you know, our chaplain, our pastors, if we needed them, that we could reach out to them and talk. People that I've met through social media that have written books about officers that go into retirement and what that's like. I mean, it really opened up my eyes, and we read these together. And it was like, oh, well, that's why. And she goes, oh, well, I get it. That's why you were doing what you were doing. I was like, and I had no idea. So, yeah, it's a learning process, even in retirement.
Yeah.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
Wanted to shift gears a little bit, talk about leadership within departments, and you know, probably from the, you know, the company officer level all the way up to chief. Ernie, I'm curious, like, your thoughts about how they can do a better job to support their members' mental health and awareness, and then, you know, the resources that they can make available if someone's having a challenge.
Yeah, one of the best models I have seen for officer wellness is something that Chief Neil Gang out in Pinole, California is doing. It's called the Asher model. So for those that don't know what it is, I would say Google it. It's a 7-step approach of building a culture of wellness. And it really does stay from rookie to retirement. It's not just that when you need us, we're here. No, no. We're here from rookie to retirement. And even in through recruitment, I think is important. Because when you look at the way departments recruit, look what they do. Look what they put in their pamphlets, right? Everything is real sexy. Oh, look, SWAT team, canine, bike patrol, motorcycles. Well, where's the officer with his arm around another officer, right? Saying, hey, we're going to get through this together. Like, that doesn't exist in the pamphlet. Right. But that's every day on the street.
Yeah.
So the ASHRAE model recognizes that. And the first thing it does is it says, hey, it's okay not to be okay. Mm-hmm. We recognize that. It's just not okay to stay that way. And this is how we're going to support you. So it's a 7-step approach of how to build your organizations, no matter if you got 10 officers or 10,000 officers, of how to build this community of a culture of wellness to support your officers that need to be well each and every day in order to provide good services to the community. Because if they're coming in tired, depressed, anxiety, they're just causing more damage to themselves and probably not doing a really good job in serving those that are calling for their own crises, right? So I love that approach. I've gone to other departments and helped them start to organize that type of culture of wellness and get things set up. And I hope that, especially this week at the International Association of Chiefs of Police that's going on in Dallas, that this is talked about. This is a serious issue. You know, here in San Antonio, we just had our 7th officer suicide in 15 months.
Wow.
Now think about that for a minute. Mm-hmm. If this was a ship in the Navy, right, and you have an aircraft carrier of 2,300 sailors, and you had 15 sailors commit suicide, would that captain not be questioned for responsibility on this? Well, our department here is 2,300 officers. There's some questions of like, what's going on? Something has to be done. So it is something that I think leadership needs to take a look at and institute early on and make sure that the family is involved in these processes that are set up. So the family's not caught off guard and they're able to say, hey, red flag. I remember you taught me about if my husband or my wife starts spending extra money, Amazon showing up 4 or 5 times a day, like something's going on. This is not normal behavior. So
uh-oh,
it's,
I'm in trouble.
I think it's something to talk about. They know me.
you modeled it to the way that you and Joe check each other out when you get in the car together in the morning. And as a therapist, that was something I was doing with my crews in EMS. Like I would check out the people before I even touched the gear, because the gear could be great, but if my EMT is not great, then the gear's not going to work. So I loved how you and Joe checked on each other. How's it going? What's going on at home? And if there was something you needed to talk about, you did it, you cleared it, then you could focus on your job for the day. So you modeled.
With Joe, for those who have seen the document, of course, he was going through a divorce. And it was a bad one. I mean, is there ever really a divorce that's good? So he had a lot going on and he was dealing with his own PTSD diagnosis. He had just found out about it. He was just starting to go to the VA. So he had a lot going on. So there were days where, you know, I'd say, hey, how are you doing today? Are you good? And some days he's like, yeah, man, I'm good. Like this, you know, I had a good night last night, took the family to dinner or whatever the situation was. Or there were days like, no, man, I was up till 3 a.m. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't do this. And I knew, well, we're going to have to pace ourselves today. So I always made sure I controlled what calls and how many we took a day. His job was to drive the car. Don't text Joe, just drive. Sometimes I say, hey, man, you're making me nervous. Stop doing that. But really, I can control the workflow, which was really important.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, because I always came to work very well rested. I worked out in the morning, had a good breakfast, and I don't know what kind of shape he's coming in. Some days were great, some days were not. Some days were not so great.
I loved how he, you know, the film also captured like the hobbies, right? So his he painted and he played soccer, and you did martial arts, and you're involved with your church and helping your daughter with homework. You know, so. And that's so critical to get that message across that there has to be more to your life than just being a cop.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't come home and watch Cops or Live PD at night, right? That just that doesn't do it. You know, for Joe, painting was a hobby that he had. We did a lot of golfing. I'm surprised that was not in the documentary, especially because he sunk like a 30-foot putt to beat me by one stroke on the 18th hole, and it was all captured on film. And I'm like, I'm never going to hear the end of this. Like, he is going to rub this in. But so we did a lot of things together. He flew these remote control airplanes and drones, and he had these crazy expensive hobbies. Right. And I'm like, I want to go to the gym. He's like, no, thanks. So, yeah, we did a lot together, but we also recognized that you had to have hobbies just like anybody else. It's just a part of creating a wellness regimen in your own life.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
One more question in this area, having to do with sort of the work, the workflow and the culture of police work, and that's around the stigma, having conversations peer-to-peer about mental health. And of course, the conversations one might have to have if you need help, reaching out to one of your supervisors. Can you talk a little bit about, how we might be able to normalize some of that stigma?
Well, doing what we're doing right now, right, is talking about it. And I've used this analogy before in the past, but, David, if I came to you and said, hey, do you want to go play softball with me Tuesday night with this group from church? And you tell me, well, I'd like to play, but I'm actually supposed to see my therapist Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. Like, that should not shock my conscience, right? I should be like, okay, that's cool. Good for you. And then the last thing I need to do is go back and say, hey, I invited David, but man, he's got to go see his therapist. Like, I don't know what that's about. We can't do that to each other. We have got to learn to support each other and be like, oh, cool. I tell you what, man, does that get pretty emotional? Do you want me to give you a ride? I don't mind. I can give you a ride. I can cancel what I'm doing and make sure. And that way, if you want to talk about anything, we've got to be better. Right. We're so good at when that emergency tone goes off, wow, we hit lights and siren and we go as fast as we can to help you. But what about when your emotional emergency tone is going off? Not everybody hears that. Mm-hmm. So you got to be in tune to what's going on with your coworkers and not be afraid to ask those difficult questions. And then more importantly, not be afraid of the response you might get.
I think first responders get in that habit of focusing on the lights and siren switch in the vehicle and turning themselves off on purpose.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, because that's a safe choice. Way to deal with life.
Yeah. And if I just focus on everybody else's issues, I can turn my own switch off and I don't have to feel it.
Well, because you put on this mask of your representative self to the world, that's truly not you. Definitely. It's when you finally find that safe place that you can take it off and then feel like, okay, I can cry now, or I don't have to deal with everything. It's okay to just isolate, right? We've got to be so much better at seeing other people and letting them know, I see you and it's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to judge you. You got to understand that. I've got issues too. And if you're willing to listen to me, I'd love to listen to you. Mm-hmm. And you'll find out that you have more in common than you think with most people.
Mm-hmm. Ernie, I know you got a lot going on, even though you've recently retired. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on in terms of maybe books, projects, trainings, events, things like that?
Yeah, I was very fortunate enough. Nick Ruggiero, who's written several number one books about law enforcement, reached out to me. He's like, hey, I want to co-author a book with you. And I'm like, bro, I've never written a book in my life. I don't know what you're talking about. And he's like, yeah, let's do one together. Like, you want to do one on homicide? I'm like, homicide? Like, I've worked a few homicides, but I'm not, how about we do one on mental health? He's like, oh yeah, man, I forgot who I was talking to. Yeah, let's do mental health. I'm like, yeah, I could talk about that. So we ended up writing a book. It was perfect timing because we both got COVID at the same time. So we had nothing but time. And the good thing was when we wrote Mental Health and De-escalation, I didn't know what he was going to write. He was writing it from a supervisor standpoint. And I was writing my portion more about foundational learning and the infrastructure of CIT training, a little bit about mental health, and then some of the federal law that goes along with helping people that you take into treatment. And he sent me his part. I sent him mine. He's like, oh, this is perfect. We didn't overlap. And we put it out. Wow. And he wrote, I think it was supposed to be a 50-50 split, man. And he did me wrong. He gave me like 85 pages to his 35 or something. Because he's like, oh, no, you had a lot of good stuff. So he was very, very humble in doing that. Didn't have to do that. But and the book went number one on Amazon. And what we found was it wasn't just first responders, police officers, law enforcement buying the books. It was teachers. It was hospital staff, clinical staff. I was getting messages from single moms saying, hey, I've got two kids with mental health. I didn't know about these things. Like, thank you for making this information available. So writing the book was very it was a little bit taxing because with that came some book tours that I went out and did, some signings, which is always good to go out and meet people. The film is still keeping us extremely busy. I travel quite often or do presentations to different agencies and organizations about the film. And now my new post-retirement second career with the Council of State Governments, I'm the Deputy Division Director for Law Enforcement. So I really get to see all the grants that police departments go out and get from the Bureau of Justice Assistance on how to set up these co-responder teams to provide an alternative response for community crisis, along with anything to do with law enforcement, right? The new 988 number, how do we implement that with 911? I mean, there's a lot of discussion going out there that revolves around mental health. So I still stay extremely busy.
Right. I think the word retirement is probably not applicable here, right? No. It's just a new chapter. No.
It's one door continued. It's
one
door closes and another one just blows wide open, doesn't it?
Yeah, but you know what? Each door, Bonnie, is really a blessing because it seems like the Lord moved me from where I was helping people locally into when I retired. I went to work for the Southwest Texas Regional Advisory Council, where I helped oversee 22 different counties for technical assistance and setting up their programs to now I work at the national level. So he just kind of puts me where he needs me. And I, as long as I'm pay attention and don't say no and buck against it, it always seems to work out.
So I'm going through a similar process at the moment. So I don't think you could have described it any closer to a T.
Ernie, where can people find you out there on the internet, social media, stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm not too popular out there. I'm either just on LinkedIn is one of the places, or Twitter at eStevens0845. You'll never guess what my badge number was. So yeah, Twitter or LinkedIn, and I'm really good about responding to everybody's feedback. And nothing's off the table. Whatever you want to discuss, I'm happy to take some time and chat with you.
Well, thank you, sir, for your generosity here today and for being such an inspiration in so many ways. You know, I think this film has obviously had a huge impact and will continue to have that. But also the fact that you're so, so, you know, helpful spreading the word on podcasts like this is it's going to really, you know, it's going to reach people that need to hear that message. So thank you so much for being with us, Ernie.
My pleasure. An honor to spend time with each and every one of you. I know that what you're doing, like I said, early saves lives. And I thank you for using this platform to take this message forward. So thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Ernie. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So remember to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook on the Responder Wellness Inc. page, bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Our website is respondertv.com with all our past episodes. Until the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.